Take a network break. Welcome to episode 307. Check out our new Halloween virtual donuts, perfect for your socially distant trick-or-treating. We've got analysis today on Cisco, Juniper, Google, and space networking. Just a couple messages before we start. Network break is pleased to welcome a new sponsor, Nokia. Did you know that Apple is using Nokia's data center fabric solution? If you want to find out more and learn about Nokia SR Linux and their fabric services platform, check out nokia.com/networks/dc-fabric. And welcome to our second new sponsor, PingPlotter. PingPlotter's Cloud Connect is a remote network monitoring, as it should be, without the typical multi-year contracts or SaaS bloat. You can test internal and external endpoint connectivity and track performance metrics with a solution that deploys in minutes. You can schedule a free 15-minute overview at pingplotter.com/packetpushers and see how Cloud Connect makes remote IT suck less. Last but not least, stay tuned after the news for a sponsored Tech Bytes conversation on SD-WAN. We're talking to Silver Peak customer Rogers O'Brien Construction. They're using SD-WAN from Silver Peak for high-performance connectivity at remote construction sites. They also handle massive file transfers and securely segment partner traffic. Greg, you have launched a new podcast, Heavy Strategy.
Yeah, it's. I'm still struggling to get the technology part of it working. The feeds inside of Apple's podcasts and Amazon podcasts and Spotify are having some problems setting that up. But hopefully, by the time you're listening to this, Heavy Strategy will be searchable and findable. Now, if you are a Packet Pushers subscriber on some of the feeds, we have aggregated feeds like Fatpipe and Fullpipe. Heavy Strategy won't be in those because we're worried that we're overloading you. So if you want to listen to myself and Keith Townsend take on one topic and then debate it strongly, some people would call that an argument, then Heavy Strategy would be the podcast for you.
Yeah, Keith is a friend of the show, a smart guy, does a lot of advising for tech companies and has been in the trenches himself. So yes, you guys both bring strong opinions to the show, but in a friendly way.
That's right. And we're going to try and do just one topic, but go over it deeply. Whereas this show, The Network Break, is very much about analysis, but at a very short, just hit the highlights, list a few points about something, about some analysis. This is much more of a considered debate and going deeper into the things that motivate product strategies or technology or how customers should consume something. Much more thought-provoking, much more deliberate, because it's just one topic for 30 minutes.
Yeah. All right. Well, we got a whole stew of topics here, so let's dive in. First, Cisco has announced a new product platform. The Catalyst 8000 Edge family includes hardware and software SD-WAN routers.
Yeah. So this idea of Cisco numbering things with, these numbers of 8000, 9000, 10000 is obviously a signal to you that to encourage you to upgrade regularly. And so this is now a rebadging of the previous hardware platforms to SD-WAN appliances to signal to you that this is the hardware family for the 2021 era. And it's obviously the standardization of the naming conventions. I want to call that out because that's important, because that also reflects Cisco's internal organization. So Cisco is converging its enterprise business unit, narrowing it down, discarding a lot of older products. And, you know, we see we have the Catalyst for switches and the ISRs for routers and all that sort of stuff. So the Catalyst 8000 announcement seemed, to my mind, came down into three parts, Drew. There was the SD-WAN software, and the ability to be able to use the SD-WAN software, the 8000V, which is that SD-WAN edge appliance, and now it will run in VMs. So it's not only on hardware, but you can still run it in the traditional mode with a Cisco Catalyst 8300 or 8500 hardware platforms. And in typical Cisco ways, there's a product with a plethora of options there. It looks a lot like routers, but very Ethernet focused, as you might suspect for an SD-WAN, but lots of modules if you want flexibility. But the big thing about the hardware platforms was very high performance. They're using their QuantumFlow silicon, which is their routing silicon from, I want to say, 4 or 5 years ago. No, that might not be right because I didn't think to ask it during the briefing, but it is the generation of silicon that Cisco's been using, and it's was previously in its high-end routers, then came down to its mid-end routers, and now it's in their edge routers, which is pretty much normal. And they're talking about 40 gigs and 100 gig interfaces for these units. So these units are for customers who want to run 40 gigs and 100 gigs of SD-WAN termination traffic at the edge of your data center. And that's been a gap for Cisco because the Viptela SD-WAN or SD-WAN software that Cisco puts out has struggled with scale. And they've done a lot of hacks and workarounds to try and get it to scale because the hardware wasn't able to keep up. So this is solving that and simplifying that architecture, I think.
Yeah, the 8500 series, that's going to sit in your data center and do the aggregation. That's got the Cisco custom ASIC. The 8300, which goes out at the branches, that's on x86.
Mm. Or in the cloud. So if you wanted to deploy
right, or in the cloud with the 8000V, yes, if
yeah,
you want a
right.
virtual instance.
If you want to go there. So they're the two key parts. And then there was also the announcement of a cellular gateway, which is the idea of this 5G, 4G connectivity at the edge. So you can have a box that comes with the antenna paddles and 5G ready so that you can, and obviously 4G and 3G, so you can have a Cisco hardware device. If you're buying Cisco hardware and then using that, you want to be in that suite of products, then it's got all the ability to be SD-WAN ready, and it does with 4G, LTE, dual SIM, which I thought was interesting. So it means it can have redundant providers. You can fail over between, you know, BT and EE or whoever your provider, you know, multiple providers in a given country.
Yep.
Because you really can't trust a mobile phone company to stay up all the time. So you need that redundancy. So
redundant
and performance sometimes too. You want to pick the carrier that's got. And sometimes also you want to have invoicing flexibility. You want to be able to bash them up on pricing and say, well, I'm buying, you know, a terabit of data a month from you, but over here this one's paying me. I can now buy 1.5 terabits for the same money. Well, I'll shift my traffic over there. So lots of reasons.
Yeah, and I mean, part of the point of an SD-WAN deployment in general is to have multiple links that you can switch over to or aggregate as needed. So having dual SIMs makes sense.
Yes, it does. And also gives you migration, I think, too, would be the other thing. It's just a shame we don't have the eSIMs. In theory, we should have the ability to have SIMs that are hardware installed. We shouldn't have to go and install a SIM card. It's a bit, still feels very 1980s every time they make me do that. Why can't I just do it programmable in some way? But anyway. Complaining about that's not
anyway.
Going to change it.
These new devices also integrate with Cisco Umbrella if you want that SASE option, Secure Access Services Edge option, where you can get cloud security services in the cloud, or you can also run security capabilities right on the box if that's more to your liking.
Yeah, I can't shake the feeling that this is a bit later than never. Like Cisco would have felt that, you know, since the Viptela acquisition happened, Cisco didn't know what to do with it when it arrived and tried to put it on the ISR and found that it struggled on that platform. And then there was a lot of features and then they had to go through the iterate. So hopefully now that product is now starting to stabilize. But it's probably worth noting that this took longer than anybody expected, probably Cisco themselves. But customers who were in that family will be well pleased, I think, with this product launch.
I mean, we've seen them doing some operating system refreshes. These platforms are running iOS XE, which I think is a slightly more robust operating system. They also noted in our briefing that long-term, they're going to get rid of ISR and ASR gateways. So this will be the platform going forward. There's no end of sale date yet, but just a heads up, if you're on those platforms, then Cisco is guiding you toward the 8000 family in your future.
Yeah, like I said, these numbers are important. The 4000, 8000. They'll now go in and say, it's very easy to identify that, you know, if you've got 4,000, that's all obsolete. Everything needs to be upgraded to 8,000. And when Cisco feels like buffing their numbers, they can go and now call it the 9,000 and then go out.
Right.
It just simplifies the sales cycle. It's like cars,
sure.
Right?
Yes.
You know, the 2020 model of car, well, it's 2022. Surely you have to get it replaced by now.
Tried and true. Tried and true. And also just a heads up, Cisco is selling these under their new software subscription feature. You won't just buy it. You'll have to subscribe to it.
Mm. No choices.
And whether that's a feature or a bug,
yeah,
that's your perspective.
Lots of people have feelings about Cisco licensing. Maybe that's an area they should work on.
Yeah. All right. Links in the show notes if you want more. Let's move on. Juniper Networks, they've announced they're acquiring 128 Technology for $450 million. 128 Technology has developed a product called Session Smart Routing. It takes a unique approach to SD-WAN where you can essentially direct individual sessions across network paths that you construct so you can meet security and performance policies. 128T is based on a software router running on x86, so this is a software play. Juniper's positioning this as a next-gen SD-WAN with a zero-trust access approach.
This is very interesting in the sense that I think you and I have talked a few times on the show that Juniper seems to have a gap around SD-WAN. And then I had a very embarrassing climb down when I said they didn't have one. And then they explained to me how Contrail and how they had SD-WAN together. And I looked into it and they did have an SD-WAN strategy using their existing boxes. But I think this is a realization that you can't just use standard routing features and overload them a little bit and call it SD-WAN. Having, you know, automated failover is not enough. You need really sophisticated a real transition in a technology. It's not enough to just create an IPsec tunnel or an SSL VPN tunnel and, you know, let traffic fail over when one of them goes down and maybe beef up the detection algorithms to support, you know, different detection processes for failure. But 128T had a really complex, now I think you know more about this technology. You've participated in the field day presentations, and there's lots of good ones. And I think the product is quite complex and quite sophisticated. Is that?
Yes, that's exactly it. And I think that's one of the reasons I'm so surprised that Juniper paid so much money for them, because 128 technology, they're doing interesting stuff, but it's really complicated. You have to sort of rethink your approach to routing and SD-WAN. And the company itself, in terms of marketing, is having a hard time deciding whether they're an SD-WAN company or just a new routing company or whatever. So it's very confusing to kind of get your arms around, even though the technology underlying it seems reasonable and good.
It always seemed to me to hark back to the OpenFlow idea, although they're being smarter than that, in that they're actually monitoring the flow state at the edge of the network and then programming the flow state in a sophisticated way. What they're actually doing is using port numbers and IP addresses, tracking the, as an application flow comes in, it maps it to a source IP and a source port number and a destination port number and a destination IP. And that becomes a, like an MPLS tag, if you like. It's a way of tagging the frames.
It sort of reminds me of MPLS, sort of reminds me of segment routing, and then you can pick a path through the network that you sort of predetermined for a particular flow to go over if that's to your liking, if it meets your security and performance needs. So there is a lot of traffic engineering and NATing that goes into this. And there is a centralized controller to monitor. It's out of the data plane, but it monitors the whole performance and the paths you take, yes.
So the technology is unique and it's a standout, but it's also struck me that it seems culturally very well suited to Juniper. Juniper tends to like complexity when simplicity would do. I mean,
That's exactly what I thought. Yes, yeah. That this Juniper, I mean, I see Juniper as sort of a nerdy engineering culture, and 128T is a great fit in that regard. Whether it's going to move the needle for them on SD-WAN, I'm not sure. But in terms of a cultural match, they seem well suited.
Yeah, and It's a question for me. Is like, I've been watching some videos about Cisco's SD-WAN, and it took an engineer over 12 hours to explain the basic features of the SD-WAN functionality. And like, it's, you know, BGP and this and this and this, and you configure this and this. And I'm looking at it and I'm going like, I've seen customers do 500 sites in Silverpeak with far less hassle than this. Why are they making this so complicated? And I'm not 100% sure that I... And it could be me just not understanding the difference. Do I really need to fiddle with the flows at this level? Can't I just let the intelligence in the SD-WAN product do this for me? Or why do I have to program all this? Why do I need to know all this? You know, I don't know. I haven't.
Yes, that's why. No, that's why I feel like this is a... I've been frustrated with Juniper and their approach to SD-WAN, and it's, I feel like they're missing an opportunity to just sort of buy a very simple, straightforward product and go start winning market share. Now they've doubled down on something that's functions, but it, as you say, is complicated to understand, maybe a little bit complicated to roll out, as opposed to, say, you know, a Silverpeak or a Viptela or whatever, where you just throw a box and you're done. But again, maybe that harkens back to Juniper's culture where they like the nerd knobs. They want to give you the nerd knobs. And with 128T, you get so many knobs that you can knock yourself out.
Yeah. And I think that culture was correct. And I'm sure there's customers who want that too. So, you know, let's respect the fact that Juniper is generally would be talking to customers and asking them what they want. But sometimes I wonder if when they ask customers questions, if you get what I call the teenage sex fallacy. Do you remember that?
I do not know this fallacy.
You do not know that?
I'm hoping you approach with this very carefully, but go ahead.
So this is, you often see in the newspapers or in the magazines, they do, they go and talk to 16-year-olds and say, well, how many of you had sex? And, you know, 80% of the teenage boys have had sex, but only 5% of the girls.
Okay, yes. So there's a lot of lying going on.
Well, you know, maybe they want to answer with the, maybe the answer reflects a certain perception of what you think you want, what you should say.
It's an aspirational answer.
Or maybe it's, you're thinking about what the interviewer wants to hear. I think the same thing happens with the cloud. Are you moving to the cloud? Oh, totally. Yes, we're all in with the cloud. Our whole, you know, and of course, and I wonder if there's just so many people out there these days that are just, you know, well, if we're not in the cloud, we could be seen as backwards. So we'll just tell them, yes, we're in the cloud. You know, so the teenage sex fallacy, I call that.
Okay. Yeah, I get it. In any case, Juniper's positioning this. It's going to be integrated into the Juniper's SRX branch portfolio and somehow also tied into the Mist AI platform. I'm not sure where that integration is coming, but I'm sure they'll work that out.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how it goes, actually, because ultimately they'll just be able to tap it into the Contrail platform. So it shouldn't take them long. And as we know from the Mist acquisition, most likely this will be added to the Mist technology suite, I thought.
Yes, for sure.
So, you know, Mist has branched out from Wi-Fi into campus and into SD-WAN, and maybe the Mist group felt that this was what they needed to get the features they needed, or the API or the programming of the flow, so that they can, you know, use that AI capability that they go on about endlessly over and over.
Ad nauseum. Yeah. I guess the thing I'm worried about is that, you know, you need to have a good story around what 128T is doing, and we'll see if Juniper can come up with a way to sell this. In any case, if you want to find out more, I wrote a blog about it a while ago. Ethan Banks also wrote a blog about it. We'll have those links in the show notes, and both of those links include links to the Tech Field Day presentations that 128 Technology has done if you want to get your arms around it a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's take a quick break to hear from Nokia. Did you know that Nokia has over 1.1 million routers deployed and power some of the largest interconnection networks such as Equinix and DECIX? And recently, Nokia launched its data center fabric solution, building on over 20 years of IP know-how and expertise. The new DC fabric solution comprises SR Linux. This is a new, open, extensible network operating system based on standard Linux. It's using Nokia's field-proven protocol stacks and provides best-in-class streaming telemetry. And their interconnect routers, a portfolio of Leaf, Spine, and Superfines platforms based on merchant silicon. They've also got the fabric services platform. This is a declarative, intent-based automation and operations toolkit for day one and day two operations. Leverages a Kubernetes framework. The Fabric Services platform uses distributed microservices to deliver a true cloud-native automation and operations platform. There's design templates, a digital sandbox to emulate your data center fabric so operators can automate data center networks at scale and speed. You can hear more about it in a heavy networking podcast we did with Nokia. This is Heavy Networking episode 538. While you're at it, check out the new data center fabric solution at nokia.com/networks/DC-fabric. If you're looking for a new data center fabric solution, you can now add Nokia to your shortlist. All right, moving on. Extreme Networks has announced that its Air Defense Wireless IPS platform can now cover Bluetooth and Bluetooth Low Energy devices. That's BLE. The new capabilities include detecting location changes on BLE devices, rogue and unsanctioned BLE detection, and a variety of alarms.
This seems a little late in some senses. I got this sense competitively that Aruba and the others with their IDS, wireless IDS systems, where they monitor the devices that are connected to the network, and that's what Air Defense is, right? Wireless IPS. They were well in place 2 years ago or more. And so for Extreme to come out with this now feels a bit of a catch-up to me. And they also specifically talk about hospitals, manufacturing, and warehouses as being the targets, but not so much about enterprises, which struck me as weird because Extreme has typically not been strong in enterprise networks. They don't tend to have the feature breadth or the sales capability. They've been very strong in government and in certain verticals where pricing is where price-sensitive purchasing that meets the purchasing requirements. So you define the purchasing requirements, tick all the boxes, and if this is the cheapest price, then this is the one that you buy. And they've been very good at that. That's their what I perceive to be one of their core values is meeting the purchasing process. So what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I know Extreme's done very well in places like stadiums, outdoor environments, but and manufacturing and warehouses where you may have IoT sensors and so on that you want to monitor. So I'm sure other wireless companies have some kind of detection capabilities for Bluetooth and BLE devices. So who's first? I don't know. It doesn't really matter. But if you're an Extreme customer and BLE is on your radar, now you've got WIPS protection for it.
Yeah, I guess they've had IPS, you know, the Air Defense IPS platform, but this is actually just Bluetooth and Bluetooth Low Energy IPS. And maybe in that sense, they're unique, but that's a pretty narrow, thin edge to start calling first.
It is to start calling it first, yeah, but, you know, you got to write a press release and you need some kind of hook. I do think, you know, we're seeing an explosion of IoT devices and Bluetooth and BLE are going to be part of that, how they connect. So having this capability makes sense for Extreme. I think it is one of those boxes that you're going to need to tick, particularly for things like hospitals and healthcare where you're dealing with very sensitive equipment that connects
wirelessly. And you've got a lot of PCs that are running Bluetooth or smartphones running Bluetooth, and getting control of rogue Bluetooth connections might be important for some of them.
Yeah.
A lot of them.
Yeah.
I mean, in hospitals, you're starting to see medical equipment come with Bluetooth interfaces and so forth. So
right. Right. Yeah. So whether or not they're first, you know, is a quibble, but they should have it. They do have it.
Yeah. Always. Okay. First. Right. We've had that discussion so many times.
Yes. Yeah. Nobody really cares who's first.
Yes. I was the first person to put my left foot forward today. Yeah.
Congratulations.
That's right.
All right, some big news. Google has come under the crosshairs of the United States Justice Department. The DOJ has sued the search giant for antitrust violations. The suit seeks to stop Google from, quote, unlawfully maintaining monopolies through anti-competitive practices in search and search advertising.
So I'm going to come at this from a different angle, Drew. I know that you're into the details of this about, you know, Google did this. And I don't really want to pay tit for tat, you know, backwards and forwards, she said, he said, Google did this, Google did that. I think that's for the courts to decide. I think I want to step back a little bit and sort of point out that when governments choose to intervene in the markets, it's usually a very slow and deliberate process. It takes them a long time. Like, governments are vast, sprawling organizations. And when you provoke them, it takes a long time for them to sort of get angry at you. And I think the social media companies have now reach the point where they represent such a disruptive force on stable society that by their very nature, the government has to react to return stability, if that makes sense. And probably more egregiously is that the social media companies have basically been poking their tongues out at the government going, you can't touch us. We're not breaking any laws. We don't care. We're over here. We're not part of you. We don't fit into society. We're a special case. You know, whatever the excuse is, that's so they sort of go like, yes, but we're special and we're different and, you know, we're technology. But and they don't care about the damage in the sense that, but I think if you also pull back away from the US and take this from a global perspective, you'll actually notice that many governments are reacting to the damage that social media companies are causing to societies. And particularly, I think, because the US government has been so slow to react here. And I think that many other countries are now saying these companies are under US jurisdiction. They have waited for the US government to take steps to control them. That hasn't happened. And so now you see France coming up with legislation to control social media. Australia's got anti-encryption law. You've got Vietnam putting blocks on Facebook. You've got India threatening to kick Facebook out of India completely. Obviously, China's got a completely different approach to it. Germany is taking steps to control Facebook and its content policy. The UK, you know, every country in the world is now starting to go proactively to engage with these social media companies and force them down some path. And I think we will soon see companies like Google and Facebook reacting and saying, oh, we've been stupid and childish. We haven't thought this through. We're now going to face a different regime, a different compliance regime in every country, the country that we operate in. Like France may say, you have to do this, but in the next country over in the UK, it'll be different and they have to comply. And that is going to be a massive problem for them because they are never going to be able to comply. And I think they're going to suddenly wake up and say, we have to get the US government to do something because we need one compliance regime worldwide. And I think it's going to get pretty ugly, but it's going to be very, very slow. It won't happen quickly. The governments usually don't. But when the hammer comes down, remember the Microsoft antitrust action against them, when that hammer comes down, it's usually very, very, like it's the ultimate breakup. You know, if they come down and just say, oh, that's it, Facebook, you're done. You're out of business. We remove your license. And that is actually highly unlikely, but that's the sort of hammer that can come down.
Well, I mean, this case is slightly different in that Google's not a social media company, so the political implications around that aren't really germane to this particular antitrust suit. This is focusing on search and search advertising. The government's particular...
Everything I just
I guess
said.
It's still... Yes. I mean, yes, Google has massive power, has massive influence. And so the government seeing that power and influence and saying, okay, this has gotten out of control. Maybe we need to step in because we're seeing some practices that we think are unfair. In particular, they don't like the fact that Google will pay Apple billions of dollars to make Google the default search engine on Apple products. They say that's an unfair practice. And as well, Google is getting pre-installed and being the default search platform for your telecom providers and so on. So it gives them an unfair advantage in the marketplace. Google will say, there's all kinds of search options available. This suit is bogus. So they're going to fight it in court.
And certainly they're going to. And I think that's a mistake. They should have engaged with the government before now to make their case. There is also an aspect in that companies like Google are natural monopolies, in the same way that oil was a natural monopoly at the turn of the century, and railways before that, and so forth. You know, if you just have one railway operated by one company, that is probably more efficient than having multiple small railways. Or the same with the telcos, with the breakup of the telcos in America in the 50s. And Google is a natural monopoly because it's the biggest and it's got so much data. You know, every click tells you that this is the right search result. And every...
Yes.
Yes. So... there is a natural monopoly there. Silicon Valley calls it blitzscaling, which is a fancy name for monopoly, but it is a natural monopoly. And maybe what we end up doing is treating them as a natural inherent monopoly or a structural piece of infrastructure, and it actually becomes a government-owned or a government-controlled, government-regulated in the same way that electricity or in the UK medical services or, you know, water, sewage and water is.
I definitely don't see that happening. And I think the case the government is bringing in the Google in particular is very narrow. It seems like they're targeting specific practices. They're not saying you're bad because you're big. They're saying you're so big that you're potentially squashing competitors from emerging. And so we're not going to punish you for being big. We're going to punish you for trying to squash competition.
But if they argue too hard and say, but we're a natural monopoly, then the logical conclusion is to treat them as national infrastructure and regulate them to death, right?
Maybe. I don't see a lot of appetite for nationalizing companies in the US.
But. Right. And now keep in mind too that what happens to Google in the USA is very different to what might happen in Europe or Russia.
Yes,
or
absolutely.
Whatever, right? Yep. So this is just the US. It's only one country in the world that's kind of taking this. It is a very important market for Google, and it is the home country for Google. And they have more control over Google as a corporate entity because they're registered as a US company. But that doesn't mean that they're not necessarily going to struggle globally, especially as the global trade breaks down and companies. This is why we talk a lot about the trade politics and the supply chain breakup, because it also impacts this type of stuff, in my view.
Mm. Well, as you prefaced earlier, this is going to take years. It's going to take a long time to get through the court system. So we'll have multiple opportunities to revisit this and see how it plays out. All right, moving on to something slightly less complicated. Korean semiconductor maker SK Hynix is going to pay $9 billion to acquire Intel's NAND memory and storage business unit that includes NAND SSDs.
Intel was historically one of the biggest manufacturers of memories, particularly DRAM, in the world. And a substantial part of their revenue actually didn't come from CPUs back in the day. It was from making DRAMs, and then they moved into flash. And Intel was a substantial maker of silicon, and they've been moving progressively to divest themselves of that business. So I think we should see it in that light, not as a reaction to the financial results, which we'll talk about a bit later on.
That's right. The deal still has to be approved by governments, including the U.S. and South Korea, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I read one analyst report that suggested that this particular plant, and this is literally a physical plant, was originally a joint venture with somebody else. The joint venture was dissolved for some reason or another, and then Intel was left holding a product that it didn't really want. And so this is a natural thing with this particular division. So again, that's why I don't see it as part of other things happening at Intel.
Yeah, part of the deal is actually that SK Hynix will get a physical fabrication plant in China as part of the deal. All right, moving on, a brief message from our new sponsor, Ping Plotter. Cloud Connect from Ping Plotter expands a classic tool to support remote workforce troubleshooting. You can collect foundational performance metrics from external and internal connections. You can deploy agents on any Windows or Mac OS device in minutes. You only pay for active use. You can toggle which connections you monitor on the fly and monitor your plan as you need. There are no 3-year contracts to get stuck in. Many monitoring and management tools have extra features that you don't always need. Cloud Connect digs deep into essential network performance metrics so that small teams can get help and large teams can augment their existing stack without needing to learn or get stuck in an entire ecosystem. You can get up to the second snapshots or look for broader patterns as you see fit. You can share live updating, read-only views of a customer's network performance. You can keep anxious customers serene by showing them you're actively troubleshooting and help reduce your mean time to innocence. You can learn more about how Cloud Connect can help you better utilize your support teams. Schedule a free 15-minute overview at pingplotter.com/packetpushers. That's pingplotter.com/packetpushers. And also, tip of the hat for Serene. That was a nice use of language there.
Oh, yeah, that's a pretty good place. Ping Plotter is, of course, a utility that I've been using for 30 years. Back in the day, it was how I used to ping around the network as we used to do routing. And it's literally that tool has been iterated on for decades now. And there's now a cloud version. So you can actually log into the cloud version and get it pinging stuff, which is really sounds, you know, when we talk about other types of network monitoring and visibility tooling, this is a very specific, low-cost, simple product that actually can just help you do what you need to do. So it's worth a bit of a peek at this. It's just a simple tool that might fit what you want.
Yeah, take a look. All right, back to the news. Microsoft has announced the new Azure Modular Data Center. This is essentially a data center in a box. You can run at remote locations. They're touting use cases like mineral exploration, humanitarian responses, or military uses. It operates in concert with Azure Space offering. So if you need satellite connectivity to move data in Azure, you can do that as well as process data locally on site.
Very interesting, because I have this idea that a couple of months ago, I said something to you about the words like modular data centers are dead or data centers in a container seems to have passed on. And Here we are. No, it's now. What I find particularly interesting here is this is a full-on container, custom manufactured. It's not like a shipping container, but it's a shipping container size. Comes with the cooling, and but it also comes with the power plant as well. So You actually just feed it raw electricity, but also the UPS backups, and there seems to be a number of options. Judging from the photos, and I could be wrong, looks like there might be a gas generator there as well, or some sort of standby source that it isn't just battery packed. But hey, whatever.
Right.
I thought this is just like, and functionally, the way they're pitching it is a bit like AWS Outposts. So this is, you know, you might. AWS said, we'll sell you a little portable box and you can suck data in, and then we'll ship you half a rack and you can have a little mini AWS on your premises. Mm-hmm. Azure's gone like, no. We're going to ship it in a container. So this is a full Azure cloud that you can buy in a container and just drop it on site, and then you've got your on-prem data Azure. That seems to be the pitch, you know.
That's pretty much it.
Yeah.
And also, if you need satellite connectivity, they got you covered.
Yes, that's right. I think some of the interesting applications for this that they called out was they talked about a space cloud powered this way. And what they're doing is where the satellite downlink stations come on, they're talking about locating one of these right next to the satellite dishes so that data processing can help. You're seeing a lot of talk in the public cloud about cloud integrations. And what that really means is that they want AWS went the other way and said, we're going to put satellite dishes near our data center so you can beam the data down to us and then process it in the AWS, which makes sense because a lot of the processing of the data that's taken in space, you know, whether it's mapping data or, you know, weather data or whatever it is just very bursty. You run it for a short period of time and then you're done with it. And that might fit well in the public cloud. But the challenge is whereas Azure's now saying, well, why don't you just put a container next to your satellite dishes? You don't have to refocus all your satellites and point them to where our data centers are. Just bring it to you. And that's what they seem to have done.
Yes. All right, so I've opened up our spreadsheet where we track all of your predictions, and I'm afraid I'm going to have to put this the data center modular data centers are dead in the wrong column.
Yeah, that's right. I just hadn't seen. There'd been no signs of life, you know. If there was a hostage, you'd have to say, "Show me your proof of life," and there'd be no visible. And then just
Oh dear.
And it's like
so.
3 weeks
Microsoft
ago,
has photographed them with a newspaper with today's date.
Yeah,
is what
I know.
You're saying.
It was like 3 weeks ago we did the one where they took the data center out from under the ocean.
And it's right. Yep.
And they've just discovered it, and now they're shipping. It's like, oh, pirate treasure! We better sell that. Like, no, that's wrong. It does feel a little bit, yeah.
Yeah. All right, we did tease this earlier. Intel reported their Q3 fiscal 2020 results. The company posted quarterly revenues of $18.3 billion, which is down 4% year over year, and net income of $4.3 billion, which is down 29% year over year.
Bad quarter. Share prices fell by 10% overnight on the back of the news. As far as I can tell, I read an article from TechCrunch about this, and they said that the enterprise and government business shrank 47% compared to the year-ago period.
Yes, that is in the results.
I believe
we call that cratering.
Yeah, that's pretty grim. So that would suggest that Intel's CPU business to traditional enterprises has halved, and yet Dell and HPE don't seem to be having that problem. So does that mean that AMD is getting that business, or does it mean enterprises are moving to public clouds and reducing demand for Intel CPUs? I haven't been able to drill into it, but you could draw your own conclusions. I read an analyst report, and they said they downgraded the stock. This is the Bank of America, saying there's no plan to update or fix manufacturing challenges for 7 nanometer. We've talked a lot about Intel's manufacturing failing to get to 7 or 5 nanometer, and even has continuing struggling to get yields at the current gen 10 nanometer process. So that's a problem because they spend all that money, but they're not getting product out the end to sell. They've got mixed pressure as demand moves to more competitive cloud consumer markets away from their profitable enterprise PC server markets. They missed data center was down 8% year over year. And they've also pushed out the 10 nanometer Ice Lake server chipset to Q1. So then failing to get the CPUs produced. And then they also finally picked out the competition from faster, nimbler competitors, NVIDIA, AMD, and other ARM-based suppliers that are able to take advantage of the foundry ecosystem. Intel continues to make its own silicon, and when that its internal production facility is not as good as the third parties, then it suffers. So, yeah.
Yeah, regarding that 47% in the enterprise and government sector, Intel saying it's because of a weakened economy due to the pandemic, and it is just one quarter, so we'll have to see what happens in the next quarter and year over year, but for a one quarter drop, that's significant.
And not consistent with the pitch that we're seeing from HPE and Dell, who are reporting server revenues are fine. Thank you very much.
Right, so, which are probably running Intel. So yeah, there is some mystery there, you're right.
There's a divergence in it, and there's a gap that I just can't make sense of, so yeah.
All right, let's wrap up with some space networking. Nokia's Bell Labs business unit has won a multi-million dollar contract to provide 4G wireless gear that will be sent up to the moon as part of a proposed return of humans to the lunar surface in 2024.
I love stunt networking. It's that's what this is. This is a stunt that you use to generate press that you're going to space, and it rides on the back of the current hype around space and, you know, so on and so forth. So I call this stunt networking. Putting 4G wireless on the moon seems, well, I guess they have to have something, don't they? Why not use use commodity technology? Why would you, you know, why wouldn't you just use existing 4G technology to do data and voice and SMS, and it makes the whole thing normal? So it's not surprising as such. Obviously, they're going to have to make hardened and radiation-proofed and bounce-proof and, you know, all that sort of stuff. But I think, you know, 4G would be well understood, so why not go with that? So lovely piece of stunt networking for PR purposes. Excellent work. More of this.
Yes. I mean, honestly, yes, it is a little bit of stunt networking. I also think it's cool to think about wireless on the moon. I wonder if it's hard to, while you're wearing a space suit, reboot a router. I guess we'll find out.
Our routers don't need rebooting. They work all the time. There's never any
Silly me.
But I think the flip side here is the 4G technology has proven itself well. They've got over a decade of running it. So to some extent, it may well be, maybe well be good.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, they're not deploying 5G, notably.
Right.
Because that would be dumb.
All right, well, stay tuned for our conversation with Rogers O'Brien Construction on SD-WAN. It also includes a few minutes where we talk about how they use robots at some construction sites. Yes, robots, so check it out. You're listening to the Tech Bytes from the Packet Pushers, a 15-minute podcast at the intersection of technology and business. We're sponsored today by Silver Peak, and they've sent along a customer, Rogers O'Brien Construction. We're going to talk about how this construction company relies on SD-WAN to enable fast, high-performance connectivity at remote construction sites, handle massive file transfers, and securely segment partner traffic. And my guest is Michael Shepard. He is CTO at Rogers O'Brien Construction. Michael, welcome to the podcast. You know, when I think of construction companies, I'm picturing bulldozers and cranes and rebar.
Yeah.
But it sounds like IT also plays a major role in how the company operates, including right at the construction sites.
Yeah, man, it sure does. And hey, first, thanks for having me on. I appreciate you've been watching you guys for a while, and you guys put out some great stuff. So it's an honor to be here.
Oh, thank
you. I appreciate that.
Thank you. And just so you know, we didn't pay him to say that. This is unsolicited.
He's not. But if this is your first time, subscribe to these guys. It's definitely someone you want to have on your podcast list while you're driving into work or whatever. These guys are great. So
you're doing my job, man. All right, let's talk construction and tech. What's going on at Rogers?
Yeah, you know, I actually have been at RO for a couple of years now, and this is my first stint in the construction biz, so to speak. And so, you know, notoriously, construction has been behind the ball in technology. You know, everyone thinks of it as kind of a handshake kind of deal and, you know, paper. And so there's a lot of groups out there, like there are a couple groups like Rogers that have really seen some of the technology out in other industries. And that's why they brought me in. I came from entertainment and everywhere else but construction. So it's been a fun ride. And there has been so much opportunity by leveraging just kind of best of breed or mixing different technologies to really innovate in the construction space. So it's been fun over the last couple of years here.
And so you're bringing, let's start. Why SD-WAN and what are you doing with it at a job site?
Yeah. So, let me maybe give you some history on how construction works for those who don't know, like I didn't. So a lot of times, you know, we'll win a project and, it's won, but we don't know where we're going to start. And so there's a lot of behind the scenes paperwork and contracts, things like that. Mm-hmm. And then once we get the notice to proceed, which is basically the signed agreement and a start date, we will have to be on site sometimes within hours up and running. And so, you know, we've got a mad frenzy of getting trailers on site. Most of these places, we're on the middle of a field. It doesn't even have an address yet. So for us to try and get internet and connectivity and, you know, just everything set up is often a challenge. And when I arrived, you know, we were a pretty traditional setup. We had just a ton of Cisco ASA firewall combos out in the field. You know, if we had 50 devices in the field, we had 50 different configurations and 50 different passwords. And it was really just a huge pain to manage. And especially these job sites where we couldn't get direct dedicated internet. You know, we were stuck with some LTE or satellite. You know, we really struggled to provide that connectivity in a lot of these locations. And historically, the solution had been to throw more bandwidth at it, you know, and that gets pretty pricey, especially when you're doing a meter connection like LTE.
Right.
You know, we have, you know, bills that were, you know, $5,000-$10,000 just because the amount of traffic we push over these connections is crazy with the models and the laser scanning and the reality capture stuff that we do. So when I came on, we kind of revamped the whole IT department. And this was a huge piece of it because a big frustration for job sites and owners was the speed, the reliability. And from the IT side of it, it was just a mess to manage. You know, we had a lot of the guys weren't experienced with Cisco. And so we had to go in there and kind of reinvent the wheel every time. So it was really, you know, something interesting and something that I think really had the potential to reinvent and redo a kind of traditional technology for us. And it really worked out.
So the before picture is you have to sort of go to this site. There may not be broadband available. So you're setting up some kind of wireless LTE option. You're pulling in routers, switches, maybe a firewall, maybe a VPN. You can collapse all that into SD-WAN?
Yeah, we did. So like I mentioned earlier, we kind of did a lot of transitions at the same time. So we were a traditional data center model where we had everything in our main office headquarters. And you're right. Every time we had to set up a job site, we had someone go out there on site, configure it, adjust it to whatever we need. You know, and a lot of these LTE sites were tough because we had to bond multiple services together.
Okay.
And we weren't really being able to leverage the full bandwidth across every circuit, right? You know, let's say we had four LTE connections all doing 20 megs or 50 megs or whatever it is. You know, we're limited by, you know, the single outbound path. You know, it was a real struggle. Like you said, we had to configure everything. We had firewalls and routers and all that stuff to manage, which really, you know, I wanted to streamline that. And for us initially, it really was, the driver wasn't a capital cost savings. It really was an efficiency, a performance issue, reliability issue for us. And in the end, it actually became a pretty significant cost savings in the sense that we are saving tons of money on bandwidth, especially on those LTE powered sites where we can you know, use some technologies like WAN optimization and, some business intent overlays, which is what Silverpeak calls the way to route traffic differently over different tunnels for different purposes, mm-hmm. And deprioritize traffic. So we were able to leverage a lot of that stuff that really has helped fine tune and speed up the deployment. I mean, it would take us sometimes a week or so to deploy a site. Now, we don't even have to have someone in a lot of cases go out there to set up the trailer. We can, we have a prepackaged setup. We just send it out there. They plug it in and, you know, Silverpeak finds its way home and establishes the tunnels and we're good to go. So it's been really a huge change for us and a huge improvement over what we have been doing.
So I presume you mentioned Cisco earlier. You're a Cisco shop. What kind of SD-WAN vendors did you look at?
Yeah, no, good question. So we looked at all of them. We partnered with a couple groups, and they helped us narrow down the search a little bit. But we looked at Meraki and, you know, all the big players in it. And it was funny because we are a Cisco shop, and I really just have a special place in my heart for Cisco. I wanted to keep everything consistent so we didn't have to have a bunch of guys and different experience sets, having to do different things. So I wanted one single pane of glass to be able to manage everything from the network. And that was really, it was initially a key requirement for me. But as we kind of went down that path, you know, a lot of these providers have good solutions, but they just didn't compete and stack up to what Silverpeak had, particularly when it came to the amount of bandwidth and how they handle WAN optimization and bonding and link aggregation. That was really a pretty significant differentiator from our perspective for it. We've got job sites that sometimes have anywhere between 5 people and 5,000 people. Okay. So what we're responsible for is not just our people, but all the trade partners. So we have just huge BYOD, we'll call it, or guest network and services. So we've got multiple sites that have, you know, multi-gig circuits, we're building big data centers or hospitals or whatever it may be. And so a lot of these other providers didn't provide that, you know, they provided some kind of like a load balancing or round robin or something like that from a circuit standpoint. But Silverpeak really actually takes the circuits, bonds them together, so you get full utilization out of everything you've got connected to it, or not, depending on how you want to set it up.
Okay, so if you have two LTE circuits and you want to maximize your bandwidth, you can rely on Silverpeak to bond those two LTEs together to get the full capacity of that circuit or those connections.
Yeah, exactly. So we use something called a cradle point, and those cradle points have two modems bonded into the ones we use have two modems in there. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times we'll take multiple cradle points and string them along together. So we can then leverage the cradle point to do what it does. And we can also leverage Silverpeak to expand the array of cradle points together so that we really maximize the amount of bandwidth that's available in those areas for, you know, whatever it may be out in the middle of a field somewhere in Texas, in West Texas.
And do you run into any issues trying to get Silverpeak to work with the cradle points?
Honestly, we really haven't. It makes the way it's set up, you know, once it's configured. So they've got something called the orchestrator, which is its kind of central configuration
central
platform.
Console,
and
yeah.
We host ours. Yeah, exactly. A management console. And so it basically communicates to all the other Silverpeaks. And we can make a change at an appliance level or, you know, holistically across the network. And the great thing about it is because of the templates and the configuration that the way it's set up, we plug one in, it pushes the configuration, does the updates we need to, and it's online. It broadcasts that new subnet to the rest of the network. So a lot of stuff, we don't even have to really worry about routing. You know, our struggle before was, you know, bring a new site on in a different subnet. Now we've got to update all the other devices to be aware of that new subnet so the routing happens correctly. With Silverpeak, it just broadcasts that new subnet, and within a few minutes, the rest of the network knows, you know, that it's online. Mm-hmm. They can route traffic to it. And it's great. You know, we've got a mixed environment. We've got a hub. Our hub is in Azure. And then we've got, you know, a bunch of edge connect devices out in the field. And the great thing about the Silverpeak as well is that it can do a hub and spoke, but also can do a mesh network. And so if we've got a route that goes down or it finds a route that's closer to a hop for Office 365 or something like that, it can redirect traffic through other edge connect devices to get the, you know, optimal path out to, you know, whatever SaaS service we have. So it it really, and same thing with Azure, right? We've got different data centers across different regions and multiple hub sites. So if we want to go one way or the other, Silverpeak can handle that very easily without, I mean, you do not need to be a certified, you know, CCIE to manage Silverpeak. It's been a really great tool and really easy learning curve for us.
So there's a few things I want to pick at a little bit. One, you mentioned Microsoft Azure. Does this mean you've got the Silverpeak Edge Connects deployed in Azure?
We do. And actually, I wish I could take credit for being super strategic, but we actually It worked out better than I expected for us. We went to Silver Peak first, and then and that was a huge pain point for us. And once we did that, we then finished or moved all of our stuff over to Azure from our headquarters into Azure data centers. Mm-hmm. And you know, that was would have been a months long transferring all the data. We have just, you know, an incredible amount of data stored on a local headquarters. Uh-huh. But we actually purchased a bunch of Boost licensing, which is their WAN optimization, like I mentioned before, and that dramatically reduced the time to migrate data. I mean, it was done in a weekend, which would have taken months for us to do just because of the high level version quality and the optimization that the WAN optimization tool does. And it also helps reduce costs because we apply those. Now that we've migrated, we take that same Boost licensing and apply it to LTE sites. And now we can really significantly reduce our costs because of that. So it, yeah, but everything right now is in Azure. And we've got the hub site, or our main, you know, our main point is in Azure. And so it's been great.
Okay, you teased the second thing I wanted to pick apart, which was WAN acceleration. You're dealing with what I presume are huge files for, you know, technical drawings, diagrams. It sounds like you're also doing like sometimes drone surveys of a site. So you've got huge amount of files you need to be moving around. And Silver Peak has this Boost add-on package, which is essentially leveraging their WAN acceleration technology, which is, you know, sort mm-hmm. of their foundation where they came from.
Yeah, no, exactly right. So traditionally we had to, especially on sites where we're a little sparse on bandwidth, we would have to do what we call reality capture, which is either whether it's a drone or even like a robot dog, we've got a 360 camera that kind of walks the site and does captures, or even laser scanners, which kind of do a bunch of laser points and scans the environment. So then we recreate it with an augmented reality or just for site surveys or as built, things like that.
You said a robot dog?
Yeah. So we actually partnered with Drone Deploy and Boston Dynamics and, you know, the Spot dog that walks around, you kind of see a bunch of YouTube videos. So we actually have a partnership with them where they've given us a bunch of loaner dogs, and we are actually mounting 360 cameras on those guys, and they kind of just patrol the projects doing somewhat real-time surveys of the site so that we do within a virtual walkthrough, and owners can then see, you know, how the site's going, especially in this time. No one wants to go on a job site.
Right, okay.
You know, and so what we do is we provide that for an owner so they can see progress. They don't have to be on site if they don't want to. And it also helps, you know, let's say something happens 2 years down the road. What we can do then with these models is do something called a digital twin. So something happens in the wall or someone wants to do a remodel. We've got these progressive stage photos or virtual tours of buildings. Say, hey, you know, there's a pipe here. I don't know if you guys remember, but we had to do this. And this is a pipe here. And this is the type of pipe. You know, this is the wall structure. We can then quickly and much more cost effectively go in there and do modifications or remodels based on, you know, these iterative scans, we'll say, of the project. So it's been really cool. It's been great to partner with those guys.
And what kind of performance difference have you or folks on site noticed when using the Boost package to compress or accelerate these files?
Yeah. So before, in the old traditional VPN network setup we had, it was impossible. Basically, what we do a reality capture to a local machine, a laptop or external hard drive. The person would then have to get that hard drive or laptop, or the person would have to drive back to the main office and dump it to our NAS and then start processing data off of that. Now we can do it real time. We can upload it over the network and it's there within hours, as opposed to just being, it's something that would just crush the network. And even though, you know, even when it's transferring over the network, you know, we put in a business intent rule that doesn't interfere with voice traffic or, you know, other priority mm-hmm. apps, mm-hmm. It kind of runs in the background and utilizes it as it needs to. So it's really saved a ton of time. We've actually been able to offload some of those scans to people in the field, as opposed to having someone who is an expert at reality capture, you know, be on site and spend their time, you know, several hours there and back doing scans. So it's really improved the speed and delivery of a lot of those tools as well.
Okay. So the last thing I wanted to mention, you said there are partners on site. They also need network access. So that means you've got to do some segmenting, some security controls. You're also leveraging SD-WAN for that.
Yeah, absolutely we are. So like I mentioned, we've got, you know, when we do a larger project, we'll sometimes have hundreds of trailers. Each of those trailers has their own, you know, unique company that's doing their specific mm-hmm. part of the project, you know, whether it's electrician or drywall or whatever it is. And a lot of times we provide connectivity to those job sites. And so then they bring in all their own equipment and establish all of their own connections and VPNs and all that stuff back to their offices. So with, before that, it was just, you know, it was a mess. It truly was a mess as far as security and reliability and just throttling people and, you know, all that stuff that comes along with that type of setup. Well, with Silver Peak, you know, it really makes it a lot easier. We've got Meraki as well as Silver Peak, and we're able to segment off the guest traffic, prioritize them, throttle them, you know, do local, you know, internet breakout so that we're not, you know, everyone's safe, everyone's separated and segmented. Right. And it's really made that whole process just significantly better.
And you don't need to add on an additional firewall. There's a stateful firewall capability in the
yep.
SD-WAN.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. So before, like you said, we were managing not only the VPN devices, but stateful firewalls with, you know, Cisco ASA devices. And now, you know, we've gotten rid of all that stuff in Silver Peak handles at all. So it's made, again, configuration turn up, you know, just so much easier. And, you know, we really couldn't be happier with how it turned out.
All right. I wish we could talk more particularly about the robot dogs. That sounds cool. And tying them to SD-WAN is neat. This has been the most interesting conversation I've had in a while, but this is at the end of our time. So if folks have had their whistles wetted, they want to get more information on Edge Connect or Silver Peak, go to silver-peak.com/packetpushers. That's silver-peak.com/packetpushers. Michael, thank you for joining us. And thanks to Silver Peak for being a sponsor.
Sure. Thank you.
And folks, for listening, you can find this and many more fine, free technical podcasts, along with our community blog. That's at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter at packetpushers, find us on LinkedIn, and rate us on Apple Podcasts. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.